We'll just start with a song that was inspired by some experiences that Terrence speaks about.
Welcome everybody to the Ojai Foundation. It's lovely to see so many old and new faces. When I was asked to introduce Terrence, I wondered what on earth to say. So I thought back to when we first met, and that was at Esalen Institute in the spring of 1983. And I'd been living there for about 9 months, recovering from a nervous breakdown, which occurred here. And I was certainly getting better at that point. I was walking again. And Paul Herbert, who was the sound person at Esalen at that time, said, "Leon, you have to come and do this workshop." I had done absolutely nothing at Esalen except sort of recuperate, and he insisted that I come to your program, so I did. And the program itself is a sort of blur of naturera, flying saucers, mushrooms, electronic intelligences. It's just a total blur. He spoke. Man spoke for like, I don't know how many hours, and I was, who is this person? I'd never met anybody like this before. The one part of the program that I remember clearly, it's interesting, was in the introductions. You know, everybody goes around and says, why did you come, and that sort of thing. And Kat said something that just stuck with me. And she said, I like his style. And at the time, I thought she was talking about your shades or your socks, you know. But afterwards, you know, I saw more of what she was referring to in a kind of deeper way. And after the poker bag of presence in my hand, and that changed my life. So he's one of those people, very few, a handful of people, that I can say have really, I've met at a crossroads of my life. And for that, I've always been very grateful. I truly have. So, I like your style too. And thanks for coming.
Great introduction, man. Well, and a tough act to follow. Before we get into this, what time is lunch, Lola? 1 o'clock? So we'll go till 1?
Or if you want to have time, you can walk around.
Go till 12:30 then? Good. Can everybody hear in the back without amplification?
Yes.
Good. Well, if I get tired and begin to mumble, why bring me back up? Yeah. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. This is sort of a nostalgic return. I can't even remember. The last Ojai event was at Camp Shalom. I can't remember. It must have been 3 years since we were all together here under the teaching tree. In some ways, a lot of water over the dam. In other ways, 5 minutes ago. I've just come from 2 days of speaking in Los Angeles to large audiences which demand a sort of formal intensity that you thankfully relieved me of this morning. I guess how many people are familiar with my books or have been to workshops in the past? Is there anybody who's just utterly unfamiliar? Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, so we'll work from that benchmark out. I never imagined that I would end up sitting in this position and pontificating on the nature of life and history and global human destiny. I started out simply with a love of nature. I was persecuted as a child in my physical education classes, so I spent a lot of time on my own, and I grew up in Western Colorado, where there is a lot of exposed sedimentary rock, and some of it has dinosaurs pressed into it. And I could always feel these dinosaurs. The largest dinosaur ever found was found a few years ago near Delta, Colorado, about 30 miles from where I grew up. And all the time I was growing up, I knew that sucker was out there. But I could never walk to it. If I could have, probably my career would have taken a different turn. But my interest in fossils, I remember I had an uncle who gave me a book when I was about 8 years old of fossils, and it had one of those charts in the front of it where it shows 5 billion years, and then the last half inch is expanded to the next column, and then the last half inch is expanded to the next column. And so I saw that human history was a hairline crack at the bottom of the column furthest to the right. And I got the concept of how old, not the universe, but the Earth is. And it was a dizzying perspective. The town I grew up in, if you read Time magazine, you were persecuted as a left-wing intellectual. The town I grew up in once made it into Ripley's, believe it or not, as a place that had more Christian churches per capita than any town of its size in the United States. This was a town of 1,600 people with 42 Christian churches thriving. When I was a kid, I thought street corners were four churches. I didn't know you could have buildings on street corners that weren't churches. And I would go up these dry arroyos with my rock pick, looking for fossil shells and dinosaur bones and this sort of thing, brachiopods. And in the solitude, because I would often not be able to con my little friends into attending me, because they learned quickly that it was hotter out there than decent people could tolerate. And also, I have to confess, whenever I invited someone to come along, it was with the thought that they would carry back the specimens. So they were essentially pack burrows for my fossil expedition. And then I had an uncle who was an old rock hound, and he introduced me to the concept of not splitting apart strata to see ancient forms of life, but slicing rocks up and polishing them to reveal the light and the color and sometimes the crystal cavities that were hidden inside them. And so very early on, I got this idea that the surface of things is not where attention should rest. That you have to, Ahab tells Starbuck in Moby Dick, you have to seek the little lower layer. And under the surface of things is another reality. A reality that reaches, in some cases, back to the birth of the planet, practically, or in other cases, in other dimensions. I had a fixation with meteorites at one time, and butterflies, and rocketry, and all of these things were about a certain thrill, a certain iridescence that could be coaxed out of physical phenomena if you would not just simply dismiss them and pass over them. And as a little kid, I had very bad eyes. I still do, but I wear contact lenses. But at that time, I wore very thick bifocal lenses. And my mother, bless her heart, who was cut from somehow different cloth than all the people around me, read Aldous Huxley's book, The Art of Seeing, which I had an occasion to look at it in the past year, and I was amazed how much of my own attitude toward life is contained in this fairly trivial book. You know, Huxley had terrible eyes, too. And he discovered the so-called Batesian method of eye exercises and eye health, which at that time,
we're talking 1954 or so, was completely sky blue crackpot type stuff. I mean, this was the Eisenhower era. And the exercises that I learned when my mother took me to this, I guess you would say, Batesian therapist, were exercises in attention to the exterior world. And then the other form of exercise was what the rest of American society wasn't going to encounter for 15 years, and then would encounter as Buddhist visualization. But for us, it was just close your eyes, and the therapist would create capsules in the air through narrative. And it was an eye exercise. And so it introduced me to the idea of sitting still and watching what's going on behind closed eyelids. What fascinated me about the butterflies was the physical iridescence, which in the northern hemisphere is fairly rare in butterflies. You only get it in these little blue lyceneas that you see fluttering around mud puddles in dry areas. I've seen them here. But of course, in the tropics, iridescence becomes a more generalized phenomenon, not only in butterflies, but in beetles as well. And I had the ability to fixate on these things, could spend hours with a single pyrite crystal or a single beetle carcass, just turning it over and looking at it. And then, at some point, again, Huxley keeps coming back into this, I decided that I would become a writer, not because I loved writing particularly, but because I admired all the attention that great writers seem to have heaped upon them, which was something that I, as a goggle-eyed weirdo, was not getting much of. And so then the name Huxley recurred again, and I started reading through all of those novels, the social novels, you know, Antiquay and Chrome Yellow, After Many a Summer Dies the Swan, and all the rest of it. Ape in Essence. And finally, I came to a work of nonfiction by Huxley, The Doors of Perception and Heaven and Hell. And this was by now probably 1958. I was 14 years old. And in that book, Huxley, the quintessential English academic establishment intellectual, describes his confrontations with mescaline and what it meant to him. And it was fascinating to me because previously all I had ever known or heard about drugs was what I had learned from reading Huxley's novel, Brave New World, which is a pharmacological dystopia, if there ever was one, and has lots to say to society today, I think. If you haven't read it, I recommend it to you. If you have read it, you recall that it was a society of people, perfect people, grown in vats, who died early, but who never lost the bloom of their youth, who were herd-minded, driven by advertising, and entirely dependent for their happiness and psychic equilibrium on a drug called Soma. And they had little advertising slogans which they would repeat by rote if anyone displayed inappropriate anger or emotion. A gram is better than a dam, they would display publicly. Drug sound proposition. Here is this same author writing of mescaline and reaching for metaphors drawn from Meister Eckhart, St. John of the Cross, John Chrysostom, comparing the light falling into the folds of his trousers to the light of Caravaggio and Duccio and Fra Angelico. And I was amazed. I had never heard such carryings on. Well, now, if you go back and look at the Doors of Perception, you realize that this was not an extravagant telling of the nature of the psychedelic dimension. It was, in fact, a fairly conservative rendering, a description of low-dose, eyes-open, thoughty psychedelic voyaging. I mean, it's been a long, long time since I've set a stack of Abrams art books by my left knee before I take a psychedelic. But back then, that was how it was done. And you looked at the visible world. Well, so then, around this time, there began to be alarmist articles in the press about the abuse of blue morning glory seeds by some of the more crazed and unassimilated members of American society. And I immediately tore out and purchased a couple of packets of blue morning glory seeds. And then noticed that the leaves imprinted in the fabric of the drapes in the living room all seemed to have little faces worth dancing. This was, in fact, clearly the intent of the designer, but something that in all the years of living around these ratty drapes, I had never noticed. And then I began to look at everything around me and discovered that this affinity for looking into things that my rock-hunting, butterfly-collecting habits had instilled in me had become like turbocharged. And swimming in the depths of polished stones, ponds, the ditch running down the back of the backyard were myriads of worlds. And I went outside and I was looking around at everything, and then I just felt physically overcome. My knees basically gave way underneath me, and I sat down under a tree and I closed my eyes, and my life has never been the same since, because there, waiting behind closed eyelids, were you know, ruined cities covered with creeping jeweled lichens and inhabited by shining-eyed creatures that were, I was not sure exactly what, and much, much more. And I just spent a half hour or so literally entranced, gazing into this unfolding reverie of deserts, jungles, machines, archaeological artifactria, machines in orbit around alien worlds, all of this stuff. And I was stunned. I still am stunned. And that essentially set the compass for my the rest of my intellectual life. I didn't understand really what had happened. In other words, I didn't clearly get it, that this was a trip and that it was induced by the psychedelic. I understood something of that, but I thought also it must be unique. It must be my mood, my expectation. Or surely this cannot happen on demand through the simple act of eating morning glory seeds being sold at 35 cents a pack down at the hardware store. And so then I began to ask questions. And I quickly discovered it was a mistake. So I went back to Huxley and read more carefully, saw that he was working from the earlier of Havelock Ellis, Weir Mitchell, Fitzhugh Ludlow. It turned out that this whole tradition, albeit an underground tradition in Western intellectual or aesthetic concern, based around the perturbation of consciousness with substances. Coleridge comes to mind as an example. And you may know his poem, Kubla Khan. Kubla Khan was written in a flash, basically, based on an opium reverie. Coleridge was an aficionado laudanum, which was a tinctured form of opium that had a great vogue in the 19th century. Well, I knew nothing about opium or laudanum or the style of the 19th century English intelligentsia, but in the lines of Kubla Khan, I could feel this same siren song of iridescence that had been in the pyrite crystals, in the butterfly wings, in the beetle bodies. Here, let's go out on a limb and really take a chance here. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a state measure dome decree, where Alph the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man down to a sunless sea. So twice 5 miles of fertile ground with walls and towers girdled round, and there blossomed many an incense-bearing tree. 5 miles meandering with a mazy motion the sacred river ran. And it goes on and on, and then it says, it was a miracle of rare device, a sunny pleasure dome with caves of ice. And that notion, not the sunny pleasure dome itself, but the notion of a sunny pleasure dome with caves of ice, introduced me to the concept of what's called in alchemy coincidentia oppositorum, where two things which are mutually exclusive are juxtaposed in a way which creates a shock in the mind, a poetic shock that is then potentially memorable. Years later, I used this effect to title my books. So that's why you get The Invisible Landscape, True Hallucination. See, this is all hideously contrived. Well, eventually, and after many adventures too painful to recall, I ended up at Berkeley in the fall of 1965, which was an incredibly, probably the most together thing I've ever achieved with my life in terms of domain, because I was neither early nor late. I was not 10 miles off or 1,000 miles off. I was dead on. I was right at the very center of the flowering of the cultural revolution that is now vilified and fondly recalled as the 1960s. And I was living in a ratty rooming house in San Francisco that summer before going over to Berkeley. And there was a guy living across the hall from me who replaced all the white light bulbs in his apartment with red light bulbs and painted his windows black and played the major chords of Freight Train on his slack guitar over and over again. And he went on to glory as Barry Melton, the lead guitarist of Country Joe and the Fish. And I didn't know it, but at the time they were in the studio laying down the tracks for Electric Music for the Mind and the Body, which was one of the defining freak albums of that era. And he introduced me to the joys of cannabis, and further to something called Sandoz LSD, which was going around in these little tiny 00 capsules. And it was as if the previous Morning Glory vision had now been lifted to a whole other level of intensity. And everyone around me was undergoing these kinds of experiences. And there was a sense of incredibly accelerated change. You could palpably feel the acceleration of change seemed to be in the water, in the air. Once I moved to Berkeley, I noticed that the large billboard that they changed for Telegraph Avenue every 30 days contained cryptic messages that were inevitably addressed to me and my affinity group. In short, serious boundary dissolution and category enscramblement was creeping into my mental universe. And then, after about 6 months of this, I had a very strange friend who lived in Palo Alto. He still is my great inspiration. I wish I could coax him into public display, because he's the real Terrence McKenna. But if you're the real Terrence McKenna, you have too much good taste to ever do what I did. But he came to me. His style was to get there first, whatever it was, to do it, to reject it, and to be absolutely contemptuous of it by the time anybody else even arrived at the scene of the crime. So in early 1967, he came to my house in Berkeley one rainy February night, and he said, something you might be interested in. And I said, what's that? And he said, this is a material that has been boosted from an Army research project being run down at SRI, and someone managed to get a 50-gallon drum of this material out of the inventory without anybody knowing. And I said, what is it? And he said, it's called DMT. And I said, it's a psychedelic drug, right? And he said, right. And I said, how long does it last? And he said, 3 minutes. And I said, no problem, bring it on. Because after all, I had been assaulted by Life magazine on the subject of LSD, and I had gotten that under my belt, and I was by now relatively sophisticated about cannabis. I figured there were probably no more frontiers to cross. And so we sat down then and there and did it. And about 15 seconds after toking up on this stuff, I found myself plunged into an elf nest somewhere on the other side of the universe. In other words, there were, and thank God no one fills in for me because they know it so well, Jewel self-dribbling basketballs. Did I get it right? Jewel self-dribbling basketballs that came bounding toward me, from all corners of this domed underground space. Well, I had been used to hallucinations, acceleration of thought, funny ideas, strange insights, hysterical waves of giggling, so forth and so on. I had never seen anything like what I was now face to face with. And also, whatever this substance was, it didn't affect me. It didn't affect my perception of who I was. In other words, it seemed to me that the drug wasn't working. It was simply that the world had disappeared and been replaced by something else. And I was still who I had been a few moments before, except now I was fairly alarmed by what had just happened to the architecture and geography of Southern Telegraph Avenue. And these things, there was an overwhelming sense of affection, involvement, a sense that I hadn't experienced since being 6 years old and being released on Christmas morning to run out to the Christmas tree. And there was a sense of childlike innocence under conditions of extraordinary alienness and unfoldment. And just, I was boggled, the mind boggled. I at last understood the real meaning of this new cliché at that time. And these things were making objects with their voices. They were singing in this unearthly, crystalline, punning, elf chatter kind of language. But it was not something simply heard, it was something which I could see. I could see syntax unfolding like ribbons being spewed out of machines, shooting across my visual field, rolling into balls, condensing as objects with rotating crystalline facets and machined interiors of gold and ivory and chrysolite. And these objects were themselves emitting strange singing language-like noises. And the whole thing was happening at an enormous speed, almost like a Bugs Bunny cartoon run backwards at about three times ordinary speed. Well, I barely had time to take all of this in and, you know, assure myself that I wasn't dying before it collapsed, the way a tent collapses, the way an ice cream cone melts, the way an erection disappears, the way an investment goes bad. It just was gone. And my friend, I was sitting there, I opened my eyes, and my friend said, "So what do you think?" And I was stunned. I've never actually seen it hit anybody quite as hard as it hit me. For about 15 minutes, all I could say was, "I can't believe it. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. I can't believe that. I can't believe that." It's, you call that a drug? You must be nuts. Drugs don't do that. I mean, drugs speed you up, slow you down, make you fall down, stuff like that. This is no drug. It's magic. It masquerades as a drug. It's a doorway into another world. I kept having the image of Aladdin's lamp, my favorite fairy tale, and I felt like Aladdin. You know, you buy something in a junk shop, you take it home, you try to clean it up, the next thing you know, a flame a mile high pours out and demands to do your bidding. That was the impression I had, and it's the impression I still have. That must have been early 1966, 66, 76, 86, what is it, 36 years ago? That's not possible. 26 years ago. Nothing has particularly changed. Nothing has ever surpassed it. And for me, that was the moment that set my auto compass for life. I mean, I said, this I must understand. Not only did my mother not tell me and my father not tell me, but Aldous Huxley never told me, and neither did John of the Cross, and neither did Meister Eckhart. All those people were apparently flying at a lower altitude than I, 19-year-old brat in ratty rented room, have been able to achieve in the last 15 minutes. And so then I began to look for this, or for some trace of it, in the history of human philosophy, in the history of art, in ethnography, everywhere. And I really didn't find it. And I really still don't find it, except there are certain faint, faint footprints in the blowing sand of human experience that if you know, if you've seen the vision, you can follow these footprints back to something like this source. First of all, I went to the library. None of the heads that I knew could make any sense out of this at all. For them, LSD defined the top of the ladder. Well, with this stuff, LSD and being at the local PA meeting down seemed to be two states of mind which merged together on some distant horizon of straightness. So I went to the library and began reading more intensively in a more focused fashion. And I learned that in South America there were five people who apparently utilized plants that had this stuff in it. Now, at that time, this was 67, this was new information, information that had arrived in the domain of botanical scholarship, really in the previous 5 to 10 years, through the work of people like Richard Evan Schultes at Harvard and William Safford and other people, had described this chemical being present in these aboriginal intoxicants. So far as I could tell, no academic had ever done it, because no description matched what I had experienced. And when I discussed this with my friend who had brought me to this place, he said that he felt that probably it was impossible to attain these kinds of concentrations outside the laboratory. And that meant, if true, that these shamanic practitioners and societies that were utilizing this were utilizing it, but that they themselves had no real awareness of what it was potentially like when concentrated through modern analytical and laboratory techniques. So it really wasn't a choice. I mean, I guess that's what it's like when you get your calling. It's just a little hard for me to imagine that, being a CPA or a city planner or something like that could seize you by the ears with the kind of intensity that this seized me. I mean, I said, I've got to understand this stuff. This is the most amazing thing. And the second most amazing thing was that nobody seemed to know about it. I mean, I couldn't understand why there weren't 11-inch high headlines on every newspaper on the planet saying, you know, doorway to hyperspace discovery, elf negotiations proceeding, something like that. No, apparently it was a private mystery, or known but to a very few. And I immediately, after coming down, was seized by an absolutely messianic desire to expose other people to this and see what they said, because it just seemed so important to share it. So that's basically what I've been doing ever since, and trying to draw conclusions, trying to understand what is this, number one, how is it that it can coexist with the world of George Bush, and not be discussed or not be part of the mix of social concerns. I mean, after all, we're a society where people jump out of airplanes on weekends because their lives are so boring and empty. Well, then, if you think jumping out of an airplane is a thrill to write home about, you should try this stuff. No one would jump out of an airplane if they had DMT on their menu. But no, apparently it isn't about that. Well, then I came to feel that it is, and I still sometimes offhandedly refer to it like this, that it is secret. It is not a secret. It is the secret. There is a secret, and this is it. It is the secret that the world is not only not the way you think it is, it's that the world, the way the world is a way that you can't think it is, because you simply do not have the imaginative capacity to conceive of such overwhelming peculiarity. And how this secret is able to coexist with the rest of mundane reality, maintain its integrity, and not become the object of pogrom, religion, hysteria, and repression is part of the mystery of what the secret is. You see, a secret is not something untold. It's something which can't be told. And even as I sit here, I realize that I'm obliquely approaching it. No matter how weird I say it is, no matter what scintillating metaphor I create to attempt to beguile you into imagining what you can't imagine, I'm perfectly aware that I'm falling short of the goal. I'm creating a symbol of what it is. But frankly, words fail. And I'm a word kind of guy. So then, the rest of my life can be basically poured into a nutshell. It's just been a lot of wandering around in various fringy places, talking to a lot of fringy people, and trying to figure out what is the real importance of this for me personally, because that's where I'm living, obviously, and for everybody else, because I assume that there is absolutely nothing extraordinary about me. I didn't have these experiences because I'm in the lineage of Ramana Maharshi or some malarkey like that. I had that experience because I'm a human being. And every human being can have this experience. The only analogy I can make to it is sexuality. I notice that no one here seems to be having sex at the moment. But we all are shaped by it. Probably this is something so taboo and not necessarily scripted into your biological functioning the way sex is, so taboo that you can go from birth to the grave and never encounter this. Not only can you do that, but most people do. And throughout history, most people have. They never had an inkling. You know, they may have set armies marching, they may have launched empires, they may have built fantastic inventions, painted amazing paintings, created phenomenal works of literature, but they were wet behind the ears when it comes to the full spectrum of reality, because without this in the picture, half the world is missing. Well, so then, how to come to terms with this? What is it? The answer is, who knows? We're not doing a very good job of coming to terms with this. Governments inveigh against drugs of all sorts, but largely because these things are sources of difficult-to-tax revenue. It's not the metaphysical concern for the health of your teleological structures that drives the government to repress these things. It's simply the wish not to be chiseled on, essentially. So, this, there it is, sideways to the rest of life. Huxley once said of the psychedelic experience generally, that it was what he called a gratuitous grace. He said it is neither necessary nor sufficient for salvation. In other words, salvation can be attained without these things, whatever salvation is. Discovering, using, and exploring these things does not guarantee you a place in heaven either, whatever a place in heaven means. However, this is a part of this world, a part of this world that you would think the restless intellect of this world, that you would restless intellect